This show originally aired earlier today.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're going to start today with our Week in Review, beginning with reaction to last night's horrific attack on Bastille Day celebrations in Nice, France. We just heard President Obama extending his sympathies to the French people and proclaiming his determination to stand with them and to continue to fight and to defeat ISIS, the president said. As we've been reporting, during celebrations last night in the southern French city of Nice, a truck barreled down a boulevard packed with people watching Bastille Day fireworks, killing at least 84 of them, including children, and injuring dozens more. There's a lot we still don't know about the motivation behind the killings, but French authorities identified the attacker as a 31-year-old Tunisian-born man who was shot dead by French police. The French government will extend a state of emergency that's been in place since the November 13th attacks in and around Paris. Here's President François Hollande speaking through a translator.
This terrorist attack is once again a very violent act, an absolutely violent act, and it is quite clear that we must do everything to fight against the scourge of terrorism.
At the White House today, President Obama said this fight will be won by staying true to American values, including democracy and diversity, and called efforts to bar Muslims from the U.S. repugnant, and said we cannot give in to fear or be divided by religion, because that is what the terrorists want, according to the president. We turn now to John Carroll, professor at BU's College of Communication. He's also senior news analyst here at WBUR. John, good to have you.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute, a Boston-based think tank. Hello, Jim. Good to have you.
Good to be with you.
Sorry that we have to start on such a sad day for the French people, indeed a sad day for so many of us. John, I'll start with you. Reactions, first of all, to what you heard the president just say.
It sounded very much like sort of a bookend to the Dallas Memorial speech he gave earlier in the week. Very much about unity, very much about the forces lined up against society, very much about coming together, and sort of a laundry list of the power of diplomacy. I think he wandered a little far afield there. Climate change, Burma. I'm not sure that that really suited the occasion all that well. But I think that what he was saying was, this is a situation where people have to come together, a situation where people have to be vigilant. The problem is, who anticipates someone driving a semi-truck down what was very similar to the Esplanade on 4th of July?
It really is a tricky quandary, Jim. You know, we talk about asymmetrical warfare and all kinds of defenses that the West puts up. But as John said, a truck. It was full of guns and grenades, but they weren't used. And what havoc he was able to create.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. Look, the context of this speech the president gave was probably in front of diplomats, from what we can tell. I don't know the context of it directly, but clearly he was speaking to diplomats. That's why he raised a whole bunch of issues that were a little far afield: Ebola, Cuba, and as John was saying, even climate change. I would also say, look, the important context here is the United States has been decimating territory that's been held by ISIS, and I understand the president's desire not to talk about it straight on and actually recognize verbally the opponent as directly as he might. But I'd say a couple things that struck me as good and bad in this speech. One is restating freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. These are things that tie us to the French, and they're important to restate in the context of a speech like this. Where I lost him was connected to chronic violence in the United States. And you could see it in two places where he said, you know, there are impulses that exist in all of our countries, and then we will be relentless against the terrorists, almost back to back. And it shows how conflicted he is and how he might speak about this. And it's a difficult thing to do. Now, on your direct question of how do you defend against this, I think there one thing we do have a question about is what were the preparations there for? How would you actually allow a truck there? And there should have been something there to some sort of defense against having that kind of vehicle, which was prohibited, by the way, from that area, to get into that area. So,
yeah, from what we understand, this truck was pretty much able to roll right from Nice right onto this pedestrian esplanade. And, given that France was under a state of emergency and has been for the last couple of weeks? I mean, it's a fair question to ask, even though Monday morning quarterbacking in such situations is difficult. But it is a fair question to ask how that truck was able to roll into that area, given that celebration. Yeah. What do you think, John?
I think that's true. And I think there are going to be a lot of questions that come up before this is resolved. Ironically, the state of emergency was about to be lifted.
Yep.
Until Hollande reimposed it. I have to say about Barack Obama, one of the most maddening things to his critics is his, on the one hand, on the other hand, approach to virtually everything. You know, we saw this in Dallas. We will probably see it here. The sort of the even-handedness of Barack Obama, which is really constitutional, I think, is something that that in many ways reduces the impact.
Yeah. Well, I want to, speaking of Dallas, let's just listen back to this week, because I want to go back and actually talk about some local news and talk about the issue of police shootings and violence and efforts to close that racial gap. But, John, because you brought up Dallas, I want to talk about that memorial service on Tuesday of five officers killed in Dallas. Here's President Obama speaking at that service.
I have spoken at too many memorials during the course of this presidency. I've hugged too many families who've lost a loved one to senseless violence. And I've seen how a spirit of unity born of tragedy can gradually dissipate, overtaken by the return to business as usual.
So I wanted to play that, John, because you brought up that speech. And I'll start with you, Jim. But again and again and again, the president, as presidents often are, put in this role as consoler in chief. But President Obama has been doing this a lot lately, sadly, for many of us. But how do you think he did in Dallas dealing with this issue this week?
Well, I think he did very well. I mean, I think there were parts of the speech where he said things like this. If we cannot talk honestly and openly, not just in the comfort of our own circles, but with those who look different than us or bring a different perspective, then we will never break this dangerous cycle. And that's absolutely to point, and that is the secret sauce, if you will. So, you know, there was lots of talk about should he have raised the issue of Glocks versus books and all that. And I get that. I mean, that's probably didn't belong there. But overall, I think he did a very good job.
Yeah. John?
I thought it was a national Rorschach test. People who came to it sympathetic to Barack Obama thought it was moving, thought it was unifying, said there are echoes of Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln. Those who normally opposed Barack Obama saw it as political opportunism, where essentially he used what should have been a tribute to the fallen officers as a place to further his political agenda. And I think very much, you know, how you came to this speech was how you left this speech. And I think, again, you know, that's one of the characteristics of Obama is he does create that rift in the reactions. If you followed it on Twitter, it was amazing how polarizing it was.
Well, speaking of polarizing, I want to shift gears and bring this a little closer to home, to Boston and to Massachusetts.
Back up! We want
So sound there from Wednesday night when some 2,000 people marched in demonstrations in Roxbury protesting police violence. This follows the police shootings earlier this month in Baton Rouge in Minnesota of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, as well as the ambush and murder of five police officers in Dallas, which we were just talking about a moment ago. But here's rally organizer Brock Satter of the group Mass Action Against Police Brutality.
It just shows how deep the discontent really is, you know. It hasn't expressed itself completely, you know, it's just a festering wound in the U.S. culture, U.S. history that, you know, won't heal until there's real change.
So a festering wound, talk there of the need for real change. A new poll out today from the group Mass Inc. and the Boston Foundation found that almost half of respondents think Boston faces some of the same feelings of distrust between law enforcement and minorities among African Americans. The poll puts that number at about 60%. Jim, what's your take on how this is playing out locally here in Boston, this issue?
Well, you know, there's, I think locally, at least in the conversations I've had with people who deal with policy, one of the things that happened over the last week I think is pretty important is Roland Fryer's report actually came out. Roland is actually here at Harvard. He's on the Board of Education, happily. He's a very smart guy and has tried to take a dispassionate look into this. And it's one of the most in-depth looks that we've had. It did not deal with Boston per se, but it did shed light on how you can have a conversation about it without either falling on one side or the other. And that is just to say, where do we see bias? Mm-hmm. Where do we see less bias? With which officers do we see bias? In what areas? And I think that's the kind of conversation we have to have. I'd say the second piece that I think plays locally is this. This plays directly in the conversation about body cameras. And I think this community is in the place where, even though we have not had the kind of violence we've seen elsewhere recently, I think among the people I talk to, and I talk broadly with people, not just in policy circles, but body cameras they see as a good thing. We would not be where we are as a country in terms of understanding what this issue is without cell phone cameras and without body cameras to some degree. And I think we're well along the way to doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess on that score, this week, Boston announced that they've reached a deal, city officials have, with the police union to have 100 officers wear body cameras in a six-month pilot program that could start as early as next month. John, sounds like a good idea to you?
It sounds like a good idea. It's one that's been gestating for a while. Yep. It's been almost a year they've been talking about this. And one of the problems that critics raise is that it's voluntary. So it's going to be a self-selecting group of police officers that may not be representative, really, of the force as a whole. There are also issues about when the officers can actually view the video of an incident. Can they view it? And they can before they file their official statements. Does that color how they present what happened on the street, what was or was not on camera? All those things. It's not that they can't be straightened out. It's not that the privacy issues can't be dealt with. But I don't see Boston moving as aggressively and as quickly as a number of people would like it to.
Let me ask you about a couple of other proposals that we heard this week. In terms of what can be done to close that sense of sort of racial division on the streets. State Representative Russell Holmes is chairman of the Massachusetts Black and Latino Legislative Caucus. He spoke on WBUR this morning and called for changes in police training. Here's a bit of what he said.
Well, one of the biggest improvements we want to see is something called police officer standards and training. And one of the reasons why is because you don't want a bad police officer to move from one police department to another. So that way you can then have it so that folks can understand they have a standard they have to adhere to at all times.
And he also talked about establishing a system of special prosecutors rather than elected district attorneys to take charge of police-involved shootings. Jim, your thoughts on that, on those kinds of proposals?
Well, you know, these are proposals that Black Lives Matters, as well as to some degree on the standards side, the president's panel on policing has put forward. What I'd say is this. I was about to say we also, on top of cameras, we absolutely need more training. And mm-hmm. the way I think about this is, again, to go back to Fryer's research, what is clear is that police touch, push, shove Black individuals more than they will other races. Well, there has to be absolutely training applied there. I think on the one of the key issues around building trust is if there's no transparency, and that's why we want body cameras, people want more transparency. We have a culture of omerta, of basically saying, look, blue stands with blue, black stands with black. And that's the fault line here. And I think to some degree, I think it's well worth considering whether we have a third party come in and evaluate all shootings. Who that is, I'm not sure, should be elevated to a federal level. I'm not sure it should be elevated beyond what we currently have, but we should certainly look at how that is done right now because there isn't a sense of trust because of that lack of openness.
Yeah, and I guess leaving the investigations in the hands of the district attorney, for example, they work very closely with police. No one is necessarily going to accuse them of not being capable of being impartial, but there's certainly a perception, right, that that's going to be a problem. John, what do you think?
I think perception is the key here because yeah. How different groups perceive this situation overall is something that leads to different conclusions and different senses of urgency.
Right.
The survey just came out that found that more people had very serious concerns about violence against the police than violence by the police. That kind of perception gap is something that stands in the way of making progress in many ways, because you don't have this sense of a unified public opinion that, number one, what the problem is, and number two, what the potential solutions are, and number three, how quickly they should be implemented. And because of that split, I think that things move along much more slowly and much more tentatively than they might otherwise.
Well, really vexing issues at the end of a really difficult week around these issues. But so I want to move on and talk about rising tuition and fees at the University of Massachusetts and the University of Massachusetts system. Yesterday, trustees voted to boost tuition and fees by 5.5%, the third time in 6 years that tuition and fees have gone up. It would amount to about $800 more per student. UMass says the increase is to fill an $85 million budget gap, which wasn't filled by the state legislature. Jim Sturgis, I know that this is an issue near and dear to your heart. I'd love to get your reaction.
So
where are we at with this?
So the first thing is the state budget did only increase it by about 1% for the University of Massachusetts. So that did put more pressure on the university system. Second thing is the 800 on average number that you just talked about, that is an average.
Yeah.
So out-of-state students will pay more and in-state students will pay less, and that's also a good thing. And one of the reasons why it's a good thing is this. Out-of-state students pay about $31,000. They go up to about $32,000. The fact is, a lot of them get merit scholarships. Probably on average, they're going to pay about $27,000. But educating them costs almost $40,000 a head. Mm-hmm. So you see UMass is playing a bit of a cash flow game here, where they go after out-of-state students to fund the university because they perceive themselves as not receiving enough funding. They are undertaking capital projects, building $7 billion of new capital infrastructure. Their debt service is spiraling out of control. And what I'm trying to say here, in short, is this. Tuition increases are going to continue because we built a model for this university system which is unsustainable over the long period, to the point where, on top of all the issues I just mentioned, you have a deferred maintenance backlog of about $3.5 billion. It's getting to be like the T.
I want to play a clip of tape from Marty Meehan, president of the UMass system. We spoke to him actually a few weeks back about these issues, around the time that the Pioneer Institute, Jim, your organization, put out a report somewhat critical of the University of Massachusetts. Here's what he said about some of the issues that you just brought up.
Yep. I wish the state would build facilities the way they do in California, the way they do in Maryland, the way they do in Pennsylvania, the way they do in Wisconsin, but they don't. The state may fund us 1 year, they may not fund us the next year, but we are headed in an upward trajectory. We want to rise in the rankings, we want to increase our stature, we want to increase the quality of education that we provide for our students.
So, John, I'd love you to respond to this, but I mean, respond to Marty Meehan's point there that, you know, he wishes that Massachusetts would support public education like some of these other states.
Can I tell you what I wish?
Yeah.
I have a ton of wishes, but they're not going to happen. You know, as someone who teaches at a private university, I think I'll choose my words carefully here, but one of the things to look at throughout the college universe is the rise in administrative staff and administrative costs. When you look at the budget for UMass, for all five campuses, 58% of their budget goes to salaries and benefits, and a lot of that, and that's up 5%, and a lot of it goes to this sort of middle management that is growing by leaps and bounds. And middle management manages, but they don't go in the classroom. The tangible benefits are sometimes hard to discern. So I would look to that across the board. This is not just UMass. It's not just private colleges. It's colleges and universities across the board that, you know, to reexamine the necessity for that kind of bureaucracy.
What do you think? What do you think, Jim? Is that a good place to start, or to continue this effort to take a look at middle management?
It's absolutely the place to start. If you look at, I can't do this because I'm on radio, but if you look at investment instruction by UMass, it is flatline. But if you look at administrative bloat, it's just going up incredibly fast. In the president's own office, just to give you a sense, the top 10 employees in his office make on average over $300,000. I mean, in every other state agency, it's not even close to that. The governor makes $146,000. I mean, they're just padding and padding. I would just say also, the president I respect a ton, but he's wrong on this. He's wrong in the sense that Massachusetts is number two in New England in terms of support for students. And that's not even including all the stuff the state takes on for debt service, pension benefits. We are investing in the system pretty heavily. They have a bad strategy.
All right. Well, We'll invite Marty Meehan back and continue this conversation, but I appreciate this. And gentlemen, we're going to move on because we have just enough time for our hubbubs, those stories that might not have made it to the front page but caught our attention. John, let's hear your hubbub.
Well, my hubbub is a recommendation, and that is everyone should go take a tour of Boston's public garden, which the missus and I did not long ago. It's terrific. They're Tuesday and Thursday, 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock. You meet at the Make Way for Ducklings sculpture. And they're really fascinating, and you would learn fun facts to know and tell, like Romeo and Juliet. The swans are not Romeo and Juliet. They're Juliet and Julia. That's why you never see any little swans, because even though one of them is sitting on the eggs, nothing's coming out of them. There are two redwoods, a Himalayan birch. There are all kinds of great stories. One last thing, there's a Make Way for Ducklings sculpture in Moscow, but the Russian kids cannot sit on them. So American kids really do have the greatest nation in the world.
All right. Amen to that. A tour of Boston Public Garden. Jim, what's your hubbub?
Well, the kids are definitely going to the Commons, but they're not looking at it. Parents can now stop repeating, play those video games, and go outside. The zombies have left your basement. Pokemon Go has accomplished the impossible. Now the zombies are outside milling around the parks and going on this sort of treasure hunt looking for pocket monsters they can train to fight other pocket monsters. Look, there are lots of things that have come out about privacy issues around this, around dangerous people getting killed, finding dead bodies as they've searched for Pokemon everywhere. Two quick things. The first one is, this is the start of augmented reality, and people should get used to the idea. You're going to hear a lot about that. But the second thing is, who makes the games has changed. Nintendo's only getting a 10% cut on this, and Google and Niantic and all these high-tech firms are taking the rest of it. It's a sea change in how we think about who develops games.
Really interesting. All right, well, so here's my hubbub. It's just to say I'm excited about the second half of this baseball season, the gamble and the deal that the Red Sox made, trading away a young prospect, Anderson Espinosa, to land Drew Pomerantz. He may not be the best. He may not be a number one starter, but good enough to be an all-star. And as Red Sox chief baseball operations guy Dave Dombrowski said, we want to win. And if you're going to win, you have to acquire someone. You're going to have to trade someone you don't want to trade. So it's a gamble, but kind of a gutsy one. And I'm really looking forward to see how this plays out in the second part of the season, which begins tonight, John Carroll, against your New York Yankees.
Exactly. Out me again on the radio. Thank you.
From the Bronx, John Carroll, professor at BU's College of Communication and a Yankees fan. Have a great weekend, John.
Thanks. You too, Anthony.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you as well. Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, there's more ahead. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.